might like to go ahead and get started as people continue to get settled a little bit. I guess the bus just took off, and so there will be some people wandering in. My name is Heidi Storrow, and I sort of come from the Quad Cities, at least in the past almost two decades. That's where I've spent my time. Prior to that, as you'll learn a little bit more today, I spent time in Europe, which was very formative in how I think I ultimately ended up doing what I do. But before I get started, and before we think about this thing called ethics, or what's left of being right, I hope you noticed the ambiguity there, I thought what we might do is go around the room and just quickly say who we are and where we're from, and if you want, what we do. This is my first time to Holden, and so I was thinking about it this morning, and I know a number of people have asked me, you know, how does it feel? How is it here? How do you react? And I figured it out this morning as I was sitting on the porch, and I think what has happened is it was as of this morning that my soul arrived. So I traveled several thousand miles, and this always seems to happen. You know, I'm always overwhelmed, and I think, you know, my body gets here fine, and maybe my mind gets here fine, but my soul is not a fast traveler. But I think it finally came this morning, so that's a good thing. So why don't we just quickly go around the circle and say again who we are, and maybe an interesting fact or what have you. All right. Well, welcome all, and I have to admit I'm actually a little bit nervous in such good company, but I thought we'd go ahead, and one of the things that I've learned over my 20 or so years of teaching ethics and things related is that probably something that you all already know, and that is a lot of times when you're grappling with tough material, the best way to get at that tough material is actually through storytelling. That was not my training. My training was in a very rigorous school of philosophy. It was in the analytic tradition, which is the logical, rational tradition. And as I was thinking about that this morning, you know, I was thinking too that my own graduate school student class, we came in as about 15 graduate students. This was at Ohio State University, and I'm the only one who made it through. And then my husband, who is also here, as well as my two children, he was the year behind me, and he came in with about 15 students. And there are three in his class who made it all the way to the PhD level, but only one made it to the PhD. One almost made it to the PhD, and the third one took his life. Oh. And I was thinking this morning, you know, what does that say about that particular school? It's high ranked. It was in the top 20 philosophy schools in the United States. But what does that say, ethically considered, about that particular school? And all of the schools were like that. We were actually one of the better schools because our school focused on teaching. It was teaching research. It was actually a split. We weren't all expected to go into publication. But even so, you know, as one of the better school, with statistics like that, you know, I think about that and I think, well, gee, if my son or my daughter wanted to go study philosophy at a school like that, what would I say to them? You know, is that really where they would want to go? So what I've learned over the years is that particular style of teaching philosophy, the style that I used when I first started teaching ethics, is not the best way to go about it. You learn a lot. You come out knowing all of the facts and the data. But in the end, I think you're poor in life. It reminds me actually of a quotation from one of my favorite philosophers, and I'm sure many of you know him as well, Soren Kierkegaard. I understand there's a Kierkegaard expert here at Holden this week. I have yet to meet him, but Soren Kierkegaard makes the claim, you know, what good is it in my life to be able to bring up all the facts of knowledge and of the Bible and not be able to live them? Right, and so a lot of times when I think about my first five and maybe my first ten years of teaching, you know, I think I can go over all those facts, but you know, they're meaningless. Kierkegaard goes on to say that if you know those facts inside and out, it's as though you are in a desert without water. Right, so that's a little bit about my professional background. What I want to do today and what I've learned about this storytelling or narrative approach to teaching is that actually, you know, it doesn't matter if the stories are real life stories or if some of them are fictional stories. You know, you have to tell which is which. But It's the story that actually helps to make the philosophical point much more effectively than do the facts per se. But it also is the story that opens up doors in ways that facts close them. You know, if you have the fact 2 + 2 = 4, it takes a long time before you can debate that fact. You have to know higher level mathematics, and you have to know about the nature of the equality sign before you can say, well, you know, even 2 + 2 is an approximation. But stories, they open up doors like that. 2 + 2 = 4 do not. So I'm going to start with a story. And this is, thank goodness, a fictional story. It is one, however, that could be very true, perhaps, in an odd set of circumstances. But I think it'll help us to get our discussion going. And fortunately, we have the rest of the week to finish this discussion, because I already know there's no way I'll get through everything I'd like to talk with you about. So here's my story, Heart Lake. How many of you have walked to Heart Lake? Okay, see, I haven't done that yet. That's on my agenda tomorrow. But I was thinking about Heart Lake. We live along the Mississippi River, so when I tell this story along the Mississippi River, I use the Mississippi River. Suppose that you're taking a walk along the trail leading up to Heart Lake, and you get to Heart Lake, and I don't know, is Heart Lake something that you can walk around? Is it partly? Partly. Okay, so you're walking along the part that you can walk around, and all of a sudden, you hear your name being called. And you think, my goodness, you know, that's kind of odd. I didn't think anybody else was out here. And the name seems to be coming from, or the voice that you hear calling, seems to be coming from the lake itself. All right, so this is even more puzzling, and your eyesight is not that great. I now am very near to actually getting glasses, so I now fully appreciate that eyesight might not be that great. So you're looking out at the lake, and you see somebody there, all right? And the person that you see is one of your best friends, all right? And you know that they can't swim, and so they're struggling. But fortunately, there's a life preserver there. And you played a lot of softball or a lot of baseball, so you've still got a good strong arm. And you know, not knowing the size of Heart Lake, you know that you can throw the life preserver out to them. They can grab it and you can reel them in. All right, so it's good. So you're about to pick up that life preserver when you hear your voice again. And you think, oh no, this is not my friend's voice. It's another voice, and they're calling my name. All right, so you take another look, and it's a familiar face. Also somebody who seems to be struggling in that Heart Lake. It's the face that you've seen in magazines and on posters around Holden Village about a scientist who's here, a scientist who has the cure for cancer. Mm-hmm. And this scientist is kind of esoteric, as many scientists are, all right? And he or she has written on a small little piece of paper with little scribbles like this, the cure. Now, no one in his lab knows the complete cure, but he's got it all in shorthand notation on a piece of paper just like this, written in ink, in his back pocket. Now, you're thinking he's in the water, so this is probably not going to be legible, but he's, you know, he can sketch that out in no time. All right? So, he's calling your voice as well, and you know it's him, and he needs that life preserver, too. So therein lies the ethical dilemma. All right, you have one life preserver, you have two people who need it, your best friend, and the scientist. So you know what my question is. Who would you say? What would you do?
Any chance that with your very good arm, you can throw it out there, whip that one in, and then swim out and get the other?
No.
Oh, no, you put them in, you can throw it again. Duh.
No, not an option. Time is short, and you just can't do it. I mean, they have less than 3 minutes, so you have to act quickly. You're making a choice. How do you make that choice?
Holy Spirit.
And how does that work?
I experience them every day.
Okay, all right. So a voice comes, and you throw it. All right. How about the rest of you?
I would save my friend, because every time I watch the news at night, and there's all the promises from all the scientists about all the fancy drugs, and it's not true, we're all going to die anyway. Mm-hmm. So one promise of a cure is, I'll take my friend.
Okay, and what if your friend yells? I see a lot of people nodding. How many of you would save your best friend or your good friend? How many of you would say scientist?
Right. You are not answering.
And how many of you would do nothing? Be so stunned into inactivity that you would do nothing? All right, so everybody would do something. So what if your friend, those of you who say that you would save your friend, said, don't save me. This is ridiculous. Save him.
Whoa.
What would you do then? Yes.
I think it depends a lot on how much you trust that person. If you value their opinion that much.
Your friend's
opinion.
Would that maybe change your mind, though, if that's what they said?
I think that's what my intuitive reaction would be, to listen to that person.
Okay.
I cared enough to want to save them first.
Okay.
Heidi, can I suggest that everybody speak? I don't know if this is being tape recorded or not, but I think it's somewhat hard to hear in here, so if everybody could speak up. I know there's some other people who are having trouble hearing.
Okay. Thank you. All right, so she would trust her friend. Would you trust your friend as well?
Would the scientist ever say save somebody else?
It's possible. I know many compassionate scientists.
I do genetics, and I'm a super scientist too.
Well, we're going to talk about scientists on Wednesday in this class, so.
We all should, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. We all should say save the other person.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yes.
I have to change my mind. I think if I'm going to be really honest, I would be so indecisive, they'd probably both perish.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I wonder about my own reaction in that kind of situation. You had the right idea. You would go with your intuition, and that's your idea to a certain extent as well, right? You go with a force, right, that in some sense informs your decision. But can we count on that? You know, how is it when we're confronted with an ethical situation, or in this case, an ethical dilemma, that, you know, we can trust ourselves, or that we can trust ourselves to have a voice in the 3 minutes or less that we have in order to make that decision? Okay, the reason why I gave that particular example is because when I think about ethics, what I think about is how it is that I should act. Of course, it's how it is that I should act. And part of what answering that question means for me is not only being able to explain why it is that I act a certain sort of way, but perhaps also to be able to justify that. Maybe I don't have to justify it to others, but somehow I have to be able to ask to answer my own questions about what it is that I ultimately chose to do. And again, I like Kierkegaard. How many of you are familiar with Kierkegaard? Okay, if you're familiar with Fear and Trembling, are you familiar with his text, Fear and Trembling?
Can you summarize the important part you're getting at?
Oh.
No, I'm not familiar.
One cannot summarize Kierkegaard. I have learned that. But I can tell you the story that he tells and his answer to that story and connect that with that need, at least I see, for being able to justify, not rationalize, one's own actions. So his story has to do with the Abraham-Isaac story. All right? So think of this. All right? Think of this. Suppose that we have the ark over there, and suppose that I have my intuition or I have my inner voice. If you read my little bio, you noticed I talked about a calling and a vocation there. We can get back to that too. So I have this voice, and it tells me that I should sacrifice my firstborn. Okay, who is here at Holden Village with me? All right, I mean, that's what Abraham was asked to do. All right? So, what do I do? You know, it's strong, it's clear. I've never had anything like this. I maybe try to question it, but it's so overwhelming. That's what I should do. And then I think immediately, I'll go through the moves. I'll make it up there to the ark with my 12-year-old daughter, right? But then I know that, you know, a deer will come, and I can sacrifice that deer instead. But that's not how Abraham was supposed to be thinking, all right? So Kierkegaard looks at that particular story from a number of different angles, all right? And he says, what can Abraham say about what it is that he was to do. Abraham says, you know, what can he say to himself? What can he say to others? Okay, that's the question. That's the question, how do we justify what we do? How do we justify that to ourselves? Kierkegaard says, it cannot be mediated. Those are his terms. Abraham's actions cannot be mediated. What does that mean? It means Abraham can't justify it. Abraham can't use human language to justify the taking of Isaac's life. Okay, well, why not? Well, in part, it can't be mediated, because if human language is used, oh, I did it because God told me so, right? Or because it was a test of my faith, or what have you, then automatically, according to Kierkegaard, we fall from a religious state to an ethical state, an ethical stage, he calls it. There are three stages that Kierkegaard goes through. So if we fall to that ethical stage, right, and this is about ethics, then that's something that can be mediated. That is something that can be captured in language. But it can't capture Abraham's decision. It cannot capture what Abraham did. As a matter of fact, Kierkegaard goes on to say that if Abraham does mediate it, then Abraham has fallen. He has fallen back to the ethical stage, which is the middle of the three stages that Kierkegaard talks about. So think about that now in the context of our Heart Lake story. All right? If you confront an ethical dilemma, if Kierkegaard is right, it can't be captured in language. You can't justify it that way. So the question then becomes, how do you justify it? You know, what is, here's the philosophical way of putting it, what is a non-linguistic justification of an act? All right? Now, faith has something to do with this. Kierkegaard has a lot to say about that. But we're going to hold off on that for just a second. All right? And maybe, Pastor Marty, some of the things that you're going to say in your Bible study tomorrow about certainty and uncertainty plays into this. Right? Kierkegaard is one who says, you know, if you've got certainty, okay, then you don't have faith. Okay? Faith is an uncertainty held fast, says Kierkegaard. An uncertainty held fast. Very different from the world that we live in. All right? But certainly something to think about. I oftentimes feel a tug between, I actually do clinical ethics in a hospital as well, so all of you medical people who are here, I work a lot with ethical dilemmas in a hospital setting. And I oftentimes, especially when I do the applied ethics, feel a real tension between pulled toward the direction of Jerusalem, right, which is the Kierkegaardian way, and pulled in the direction of Athens, which is the philosophical Socratic way. All right, so I feel that stretching. I think, however, that divide, as it's sometimes been called, between Athens and Jerusalem is not absolute. All right, because if you read Socrates, especially if you read the early Socrates, the non-Plato Socrates, so his early, early dialogues, Socrates makes a distinction that I think might help us here in justifying, without words, our actions, like Abraham did, or like Kierkegaard says that Abraham should. All right? So what does Socrates say? Socrates says there's a very important difference between knowledge and what?
Wisdom.
Wisdom. All right? So knowledge is that fact. It's that objective certainty that many modern rational people will hold fast to. It's that 2 + 2 = 4 approach to life. Okay, that's knowledge. That's called episteme in Greek. But there's another word in Greek, well developed within Greek philosophy, especially the early Greek philosophy, which is noesis. And noesis means wisdom. And Socrates, to a much lesser degree, Plato, and certainly by Aristotle, that distinction was lost. Aristotle was all about facts. But Socrates said wisdom is the highest form of being human. And wisdom is not knowledge. In order to have wisdom, he says, you have to move through knowledge. Okay, you cannot completely ignore the facts. Right? You can't make decisions in hospitals about ethical dilemmas if you don't know the facts. So you have to know the facts. You have to know that 2 and 2 is 4, right? But you don't get stuck there. And that's what Kierkegaard warns against. That's what Socrates warns against. All right, so any comments, questions?
Well,
great.
The closest thing, if you're talking about that you're not doing it by, I mean, if this is just me and I'm there at Heart Lake and not using, you know, the whole justification thing, the only thing I can associate with at this point in time would be my gut reaction, and that would be I grab it and I look and I throw.
Right.
Which is interesting. I mean, me, I'm an analytical fact kind of guy, and it would be going through my mind the whole decision-making thing. But if you're going beyond that, then it's just gut feeling without analyzing where that came from.
And the question is, how raw is that gut feeling? Pretty raw. What does it take? Should it stay raw like that? What is that moral intuition? There's your word again. What is that moral intuition that we have in that situation? Where does that come from? How do we know it when we have it? One ingredient that you have to have is knowledge of who you are, right? Knowledge of who you are. Because otherwise, what we end up with is a kind of relativism, each on his own, right? So what you decide to do at Heart Lake may be different from what I decide to do at Heart Lake, all right? And anything goes. I mean, if somebody decides, oh, well, this is just way too complicated for me, I'm going to turn around and walk away, right? Then that's okay for them too, if something like relativism is what we want as an ethical theory. That's not, I think, what we want as an ethical theory. As a matter of fact, I could tell you a logical story which shows you that relativism is actually logically inconsistent. It's like saying that you're, you know, sitting and standing at the same time. So relativism is not an option. So if we get to that moral intuition, we have to know ourselves, who we are, right? And then it's not quite as raw as if we had never thought about this in the first time. And I have an example that we're going to take a look at in just a second. Yes?
I wonder if it's knowledge in who you are, or if it has to do more with the Isaac Abraham story that's faith in something maybe greater than you or within you.
I think it is knowledge, faith, and wisdom.
Okay.
At least of all, perhaps, ultimately knowledge. Again, because I think Kierkegaard has that right. Kierkegaard makes leaps from one stage to the other. And I think that, you know, that knowledge is absolutely necessary, but we have to leap beyond that. And that's where the faith and the wisdom come into play.
Would that be the primary?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. Yes, it would. All right, so two more things. One more thing before we get to my next story. My next story is a real one, and I'll give you some background on that. That particular example, that type of example that forces us into an ethical dilemma, is oftentimes used in courses on ethics to demonstrate a difference between two kinds, two approaches, two theoretical approaches to moral decision making. Okay? This is interesting. One of these moral approaches is known as utilitarianism. It's sometimes called consequentialism, but it's more commonly known as utilitarianism. It's utilitarianism that in some respects forms one of the major foundations of our own country. All right, so Thomas Jefferson certainly was a utilitarian. So was Ben Franklin, and so were many others. So there the idea is greatest good for greatest number. Okay, our moral decision making ought to involve greatest good for greatest number. So think of democracy. Right? That's a political theory. It's not necessarily an ethical theory. One would hope they'd coincide, but even so, we can tease them apart. All right? There, even in that political theory, we have greatest good for greatest number. If you look at any of contemporary policy making, it's always greatest good for greatest number. That is one long tradition, that goes back to England primarily, of making moral decisions. So if you're a utilitarian, you don't have much to think about in the Lake Hart example, or Hart Lake example. Why not? Because you'd save the scientist. Right? How could it possibly be the case, the utilitarian would say, that you would save one person when you could save millions? Okay, and that one person might get cancer, and then they could have been saved had you only made the right utilitarian decision. Right? Greatest good for greatest numbers. That's why I called this particular session Painting by Numbers, because there the ethical picture is painted literally by numbers. And you can buy ethics books this thick in utilitarianism, which will go through a moral arithmetic, a hedonic calculus, and everything is laid out in number form. Unbelievable, interesting, in that, again, it's a cornerstone for our social political thinking. And secondly, it is one of the leading moral theories available to us. All right, so what's the option? What's the alternative to utilitarianism? The alternative to utilitarianism is something called deontology. Deontology is an interesting word. If you split it apart, it has, again, Greek origins. If you split that word apart, it plays into two bigger concepts. Deon, or deontos, means rule-driven. Okay, rule-driven. Not consequence-driven, but rule-driven. You might wonder about what kind of rules. We'll get to that. All right? Ontos, which is also part of that word, deontology, means being. Ontos means that which is. Being. Right? So if you're thinking of existentialist literature, if you're thinking of authenticity, if you're thinking of people like Kierkegaard again, or maybe people like Heidegger, you know, they talk, or Sartre even, although he's a little bit different, they talk about this thing called being, that which is. All right, so there's the divide. And the divide is huge between practical cost-benefit analysis utilitarianism and this more nebulous stuff that has rules, but it also has being. What in the world is being? Anybody have a clue what being is? What that which is refers to? That makes for an interesting ethics. All right. Anybody can do utilitarianism. All right. So in terms of deontology, there are two main traditions. Okay. So there's a split in the deontological side. Think about it in terms of rules. Some will defend the view that there's only one absolute moral rule. Okay. Very famous example historically is a philosopher out of Germany called Immanuel Kant. He had something called the categorical imperative. It's sort of like the golden rule. He specifically says that's not true, but it is close to it. It really is. If you look at the details, I think in the end they come out very similar. All right. The other tradition is a pluralistic rule deontology, which says that there are many rules. For example, maybe it's something like the Ten Commandments. Interesting thing about the deontological side, the rule-based side, the ontos side, is that there are absolutes there. Okay? Utilitarians don't have any absolutes. For them, it's all about the numbers. Sometimes you save the life, sometimes you don't. All right? But there are absolutes on that other side, that side of being. All right? So, you know, the idea there is there are things that are intrinsically valuable. There are things that are good in and of themselves, period. You know, it's pure goodness. The utilitarians don't have that. All right? So that's the divide. That's the kind of thinking, right, that we should go through at some point in our lives, or maybe always in our lives, so that we know maybe a little bit about that voice that tells us to do things. Right, about that raw feel, as I like to call it, or that moral intuition, or that calling, right? I mean, we can't just, as again Kierkegaard would say, have a kind of blind faith about that. We can't have a blind faith about that. It has to come from who we are as beings. And there's that ontos idea again. So let me give you another story. The second story, I have a brother. My brother is an ethnobotanist. He lives in Germany, and his area of specialization is Ethnobotanical medicines of indigenous people. He has studied, for example, the Native Americans in Wyoming. He has studied a tribe, actually, that lives up in the Kashmir region of India. And his last group of study is in the Swiss Alps, in the Emmental. And he's found that these three very different groups of people have similar core values, all right? I mean, vastly different cultures, vastly different religions, vastly different histories, but they all have the same core values when it comes to their medicine. And ethnobotanical practices of medicine are very different than our traditional modern practice of medicine. They involve a philosophy, they involve a religion, they involve a healing, right? So it's a much broader view that he has compiled in these three views. So he has a friend who was a professor at the University of Chicago. This was maybe, this was in the, let's see, 60s, mid-60s. And his friend was an ethnobotanist, worked out of the anthropology at the University of Chicago. And his area of research, his friend's research, was in South America in the rainforest. I think it was in the Brazilian rainforest, but I might have that wrong. And for 20 years, his friend, every summer, would spend the summer in this region, very, very remote region of the rainforest, where he always went to the same tribe. And the tribe, after, 20 years of this, welcomed him as one of their own. They celebrated his arrival. So it was actually in year 18 of traveling down there that he arrived, as he always did, and he indicated, after he had been there for a couple of weeks, that he was going to travel to an even more remote part of the jungle, where he had heard that there was the climate conditions for a particular very, very rare plant, a medicinal plant that grew there. And he wanted to see if he could find this plant. And he had every reason to believe that it would be there. The villagers said, not a good idea. Not a good idea to travel there. Because in that particular area, there had been some fighting among Native people. There had been a lot of guerrilla warfare. It was not a safe place to travel. He said, look, I've been doing this for 18 years. I know how to handle myself. I think we can do it. And they wrestled back and forth for a few days about this. But he eventually convinced them, okay, go, but come back, right? Come back in the evening. Don't stay overnight there. Don't camp there. So, fine, he set out very early on this trek. He recounts that at times the rainforest, I've never been in a rainforest. Has somebody been in a rainforest? Okay, so sometimes it is so hard to get through the remote areas that you literally use a machete to cut your way through, he says. So, in any case, he was there, all right? He was getting further and further away when he heard voices. Okay, again, he heard some human voices. He was sure they were human voices. So he thought, that's rather odd. I think I'm going to go over in that particular area. All right? So he goes to that particular area, and sure enough, there are people there. There are two armed guerrillas, okay, guerrilla warfare militia kind of people, and then there are a line of 12 indigenous people, tribal leaders from a number of the different tribes in the area. And he's looking at the situation. It's in a clearing, sort of a clearing of about the size of a football field. All right. What he sees is a firing squad. All right. He says, this can't be good. But as he's seeing this, all right, they see him too. All right. So he can't just run back into the jungle. So he walks over to the armed fellows. He doesn't know them personally. He does know some of the tribal leaders. And he says, what are you doing? I know these are innocent people. What are you doing? This is a line if you're going to kill them? And they said, yeah. We need to show who is actually in charge, who is in control of this particular area, and this is the way that we're going to prove our point to the villagers back home. All right? So the anthropologist says, there's no way you can do that. I'll go back, and I'll report it. And if they don't, if you shoot me too, they're going to come and find you. Okay? They're going to see what has happened here. You can't do it. So he argued with them for quite a while, all right? He knew the ways of these people, all right? Argued with them. They finally made a deal with him. And the anthropologist's rule of thumb is that if they make a deal with you, all right, then they'll stick by that deal, All right, so this is not a hoax. If they say they're going to do something, they're going to do something. And here was the deal. We'll hand you one of our guns. You shoot one of them, and we'll let the rest go. That's an ethical dilemma, again. All right? So here he is, a real, live, flesh-and-blood person, right, who's now got that raw feel. He's got that intuition, or maybe not, all right? He's got the gun in his hands. The way he talks about it is they literally just shoved the gun in his hands. He's never held a gun before in his life, all right? So what's he do? Yeah.
He doesn't take the gun. I mean, I guess here's what I would do.
He gives it back, is what you're saying.
I would give it back because in giving it back, those two guys are goners. I mean, in a sense, if they choose to shoot any one of those people, people are going to come after them. If he shoots the anthropologist, people are going to come after them. So to appeal to their sense of self-preservation, he would give the gun back to them.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if he gives the gun back to them, then I think it would have been a fair bet that he, the anthropologist, and all 12 would have been shot. And then what your claim is, they'll find those two people, the villagers, and go after them, whatever that might mean.
It depends on how good a persuader he is. If they really value their lives, and maybe they don't. If they value their lives, then he'll give the gun back to them.
Okay. All right. But he knows he could save 11 lives plus his own if he takes the life of one.
Well, I'm not in that situation. It's easy for me to philosophize here in a room where I'm comfortable and all that.
Yeah, right, right. That's part of the problem of a moral dilemma, right? And it doesn't get any easier, ever. How about the rest of you? Any intuitions on that? I'll tell you what happened in his story.
Well, I would shoot one of the guys.
You would.
It's 13 against one.
Smart idea, except for they have more guns, right? I mean, they have a lot of guns on them, and they're better at shooting than you are, presumably.
Because he's never held a gun.
Okay, so if you shoot one of them, who knows how that'll turn out, but you know then that you are a goner, as well as all the others.
You know your odds are better.
Yeah.
13 against one versus 13 against two.
I don't know. That's pretty risky to me. How about some of the rest of you?
She's got an answer.
Oh, good. I didn't see you. Sorry.
I think I'd go to the 12 and tell them the dilemma and say, is one of you willing to take the shot?
Okay, you know what? You're jumping ahead in the way that it worked out.
Oh, well,
so,
I didn't mean to.
This is your moral intuition, right? So he's holding this gun. He is dumbfounded. No, how would you feel? I have never held a gun. I used to work for the Forest Service for a while, and they had actually training where we all needed to know how to use these rifles, and I refused to go to that training. So they gave me hard labor building these metal cages instead, which was a fair trade as far as I was concerned, but that was the closest I ever came to holding a gun. So in any case, presumably none of us have held this gun before. So now we're holding this very powerful weapon, right? And what are we going to do? So he's looking at this thing. He's looking at the people who shoved the weapon into his arms. He looks out at the 12 people lined up, and you know what they do? They raise their hands because virtually every one of them is volunteering to take the bullet.
Oh.
So nice idea, but not helpful.
Can he shoot just one of them in the foot?
No, no, doesn't
try,
work.
Try.
Nice try.
He could miss. He's never held a gun.
Yeah. Well, he's got.
He did his part of the deal. He
right.
But he missed.
I don't think that's what they intended, though. Nice try. So, what do you do? Anybody else have an idea here? So the utilitarians, we know what they would do, right?
The oldest one.
It's not a question. Yeah,
they
right.
The oldest one.
Absolutely right. Their cost-benefit analysis, if they, you know, were astute at doing their utilitarian calculations, would shoot the oldest. Absolutely. My dissertation advisor, he's a great guy, but he is a cold-hearted utilitarian. I could tell you stories about him that would just baffle you. But in any case, you're absolutely right. The right thing to do, the morally correct action, would be to shoot one of them and presumably a volunteer, the oldest volunteer. My, yeah, go ahead. Absolutely. Because of those intrinsic values, right? There are some things that are absolutely wrong. So my brother's friend was a deontologist. He didn't know it. You know, he didn't know he was a deontologist. He didn't go through all this stuff. But he was a deontologist. He said, I can't do it. You know, I just can't do it. All right? I can't. Again, this is the unmediated part. I can't explain it. I just can't do it. So he hands the gun back, all right? He turns around. He walks back into the rainforest as he hears the 12 gunshots going off. Okay. So there are these things called moral traces. It's a haunting notion. But the idea is for any kind of ethical dilemma, all right, there are moral traces. Those moral traces are things that linger. All right. You don't work your way through, you know, the deontological side of a moral dilemma and then think, aha, I got it, you know, I'm all clear until the next one comes up. Right? It doesn't work that way. Those moral traces linger. So he heard those shots, and he heard those shots when he went home, back to the tribe, and he left immediately. He told the tribal members what had happened. He went back to Chicago. He still heard those shots. He couldn't get them out of his head, right? He stopped teaching. He doesn't teach anymore. He did go into various kinds of counseling. It's better now for him. But there are times when he still hears those shots. And when you ask him, you know, would you have done anything otherwise? His answer is, nope. Nope. Could not have done it otherwise. So
well,
he said...
That wasn't his thing.
Right.
So then he would need more counseling.
Right.
So we would predict.
Right. Right.
His counseling, even one
right.
shot, 12 shots, nothing.
Right. Right.
So could he have said, I cannot kill because killing is wrong. Kill me. Because that would have been actually nicer for him than living in this hell.
Right. Right. That's right.
But they wouldn't have accomplished their goal.
Right. Right. Then he would be dead, and the others would also be dead. Right? I mean, they were going to die no matter what if he didn't take the life of one. Right? And so what can you do? What can you do in that case? But the point, one of the points there, besides the awfulness of ethical decision-making sometimes, is that, you know, that justification that we started off with when we first began, you know, that idea that when you think about ethics, you got to be able to, you know, sort of explain how it is that you do what you want to decide. But you also have to justify that. You know, he's justified it. It hurts. It hurts. But he says, there's no way I could have done anything else. That was the right thing to do. So Kierkegaard, again, and Kant, also a deontologist, and many, 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 many people on the deontological side will say ethical decision-making is never easy. And somebody, I think Peter Thompson, do I have that name right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's going to be talking about that as well. I read one of his blurbs that I think maybe is on Wednesday, where he he's going to talk about whether or not, you know, doing the right thing is so important to someone that it might result in imprisonment for you. Right? So, I mean, that's, again, a similar kind of situation. If an act of civil disobedience, right, or a moral action knowingly on your part leads you to life imprisonment, you know, is that something that you can do? Is that what your raw feel, your inner voice says you ought to do, right? In his case, in my brother's friend's case, he's suffering. There's no doubt about that. But maybe he's suffering well. Right? I mean, I don't think it's a different kind of pain. It's a moral trace that he's suffering from. You know, and he's not a happy-go-lucky kind of guy anymore, right? But he has a depth that few other people have, right? That kind of depth that, I don't know. It's just, it's inexplicable. It can't be mediated. Yeah. But what a person. What a person.
Yeah.
If I haven't shot a gun, but if I were that anthropologist and I knew how to use a gun, one of the first things in my mind is there any way I can grab that gun and quickly shoot the other two?
That's what you
and
were
I'm wondering
suggesting.
How would be the ethical response, ethical interpretation of that? Then you're saying these people are worth saving, but those two people aren't.
Right. For the deontologist, and actually, it's funny that you note that there are different kinds of deontologists, of course. But for, let's say, Immanuel Kant, since I mentioned him earlier, he would say that that kind of decision-making is okay, all right? Because in some sense, they have given up certain rights and privileges that the rest of us have not, okay? So that's the kind of Kantian line. Other deontologists say, of the pacifist sort, you cannot take the life of another human being intentionally. All right. Some even, as you all probably know, will make the claim you can't even take it in self-defense. All right. So there is disagreement among the deontologists, as there is among the utilitarians as well.
I was just going to say, and deontologists just say there are rules. They don't necessarily agree on what the rules are, right?
As a big group, they do not agree upon what the rules are. But they do agree that there are absolutes in morality and that some things are intrinsically valuable or not. Yeah. And one of the hopes of the deontological side, and their position makes this possible, is that through discourse, through some would say even meditation, through dialogue, you can narrow what those rules are. All right. Now, whether or not you're going to come up with a single set for all deontologists, I don't know, but it is logically possible, given their position, that you could, okay, and they all know that and strive for that. For the utilitarians, as a contrast, again, that's not doable, because everything depends upon time, place, and circumstance and what produces the best outcome. All right. Let me say one other quick thing, and then maybe there are a couple more questions. One of the things that I find most interesting when I do real-world ethics, which is the clinical ethics that I do, is I constantly confront this kind of debate between the utilitarians and the deontologists. And I think it's a microcosm of what happens within the United States as a whole. Have you noticed that there are some moral issues that we just can't solve? I mean, mm-hmm. I think we've solved the slavery issue. I think we all now agree, I think all reasonable people agree that slavery is wrong. But we are nowhere near that kind of agreement when it comes to things at the beginning of life, right, or things at the end of life, so like abortion or things like the death penalty, of which there was a very recent case of a firing squad in Utah. You may have heard about that. So why is it, you know, what do I see at the hospital that I work in that I think reflects the larger whole? And what I see is a tension between our utilitarian and deontological sides. As a melting pot, we have both. So we have the deontological view embedded in, at least for many people, in their religious history, in their family's religions, right? Even if they're not practicing, say, Catholics or Lutherans or Methodists, it's still part of their legacy, their family legacy. That's deontological stuff. But then you have social political policy making, which is not that. I mean, after all, we have the separation of church and state. Right? So it is the more secular utilitarianism. So how are we ever going to come to moral resolve with those two competing traditions? That's a tough one. That's a situation that I think confronts us as a country far more than many other countries. Many other countries, they are either much more thoroughly going utilitarian countries. Ask me some time about my own childhood in East Germany, which informs certainly the person that I am now. Okay, that was clearly a utilitarian kind of situation, all right? And then clearly we have countries that have very strong religious backgrounds. Think of Muslim countries, for example, right? So there, they don't have the same kind of ethical tensions that we do, all right? And I think that's an interesting kind of reflection about our own state in the United States. And it may solve a number of the issues that we just can't solve as a people, it seems.
Huh.
So do you learn these two sides, or are you born with them? Because most of us are walking around not put in those situations. So when you're in that really bad situation and you hear the calling, or whatever you want to call it, were you trained to be a deontologist? Were you trained to be, or are you born with it? So it has nothing to do with the culture. You know, but it's,
I think it's both. I actually think it's both. And again, I think the existentialists have a lot to say about that. And I can end on this note. Part of the tension is between the subjective and the objective. All right. So the utilitarians' cost-benefit analysis—it's all about numbers, objectivity. Right. That's why they talk about the moral arithmetic. The deontological side is more subjective. It's not a relativism. But it is a subjective side that takes that ontos notion, that being notion, into account. All right. So part of what I think the existentialists get right, and this is part of the answer to your question, I think, is that you can't do exclusively one or the other. Somehow you got to bring those two together. And so, you know, Kierkegaard will talk about the God-man relationship. Fascinating stuff. All right. Other deontologists and...